We look forward to the beginning of our summer series of lectures and on the general theme of things most surely believed. There is nothing more fundamental to our faith than our belief in God, and nothing more important than realizing that God does indeed exist. If He does not, then all that we are striving to do here is pointless. It is important for us to be able to establish the fact that God is. And with that thought in mind, let us turn to this passage from Hebrews, the 11th chapter and verse 6, in which the writer said that without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. This points out that God is eternal in being. He simply is. Regardless of the frame of reference, God is present. He didn't used to be. It is not that He will be. It is rather that He exists. God is, has neither origin nor termination. And He is a rewarder of those that by faith seek Him. Entirely possible that with every good intention, someone could make a promise to you of what they will do tomorrow and not be alive to keep the promise. Not so with God. God rewards and ever exists to keep God's promise to those that seek Him. You can always count on God. There's no thought, I think, more profound nor more inspiring of godly, righteous endeavor than our conviction that God is, and that God is a rewarder of those who by faith seek Him. But neither is there any concept more controversial, disputed and rejected by many as unreasonable and unscientific. We're going to be spending quite a bit of our time with those two concepts. We're going to observe a few evidences for the existence of the God of the Bible, and these are going to necessarily and purposefully be simple. Necessarily because a lesson like this can become very, very technical and vaguely philosophical, and that is not helpful to us. It gives us nothing that we can put in our pocket and take with us and use as we strive to talk to others and as we strive as well to firm up our own faith in God. And we will keep it simple because there is no need to do otherwise. But the lesson will be sufficient, I think you will find, to justify faith in God as both reasonable and in harmony with the facts of science. So, saying that God is, let's take a look at the first of three very simple, very fundamental evidences that we want to discuss tonight. And the first one is design. Webster's definition of that term is deliberate, purposive, a planning. In other words, it indicates that somebody put thought into something and that they brought it to pass. Now, let's take a couple of examples. First of all, negatively, here's a person, let us say, who is out in our woods in this part of the country, and he observes a little berm, a little ridge of rock and soil that serves no purpose. It's just there, and thus no evidence of design. But from a positive point of view, we have a berm of earth and rock that is deliberately placed across the bedrock of a stream bed and equipped with a spillway to control water depth and flow. Clearly, here is evidence of design. The thing is built that way and it's there for a purpose. Well, we also point out that design evidences a designer. One finding this berm that we've already introduced, serving no purpose, would see neither evidence of design nor of a designer. but only an accident of nature. The thing is just there. But on the other hand, as we have described berm in an entirely different framework, one finding a berm of earth and rock across a stream bed that's been excavated to bedrock and leveled across its length, equipped with a spillway to regulate water level, could logically reach no other conclusion than that someone designed it as a dam. Design evidences a designer. Now, our universe evidences design, and therefore a designer. I think we'll see that that's inescapable. Let's talk about the solar orbit of the Earth. That is the orbit that the Earth makes about the Sun. It is estimated that the weight of the Earth is 6,570 quintillion tons, and the Earth's solar orbit to be about 292 million miles. Now, that's a tremendous amount of weight. It's just inconceivable, but I suppose that given the mass of the Earth and the density of its makeup, its rock, its soil, and so forth, you could come up with a ballpark figure of its weight, and so that's what we have here. The orbit of the Earth around the Sun is very measurable, the 292 million miles, and yet the Earth's solar orbit is measured to a fraction of a second, 365 days, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and 45.51 seconds, year after year after year. Now you think about the immense size of the universe that is involved here, and the precision with which it functions. Someone said, well, how can that be? Well, how could we possibly place, let us say, a man on the moon or a spaceship around Mars if we did not have the ability to make these calculations? The Earth evidences God's wisdom and God's power, God's preciseness in our universe. Let's talk about another matter, meiosis. That's a word we use every day, right? Well, meiosis has to do with cell division reduction, and we'll explain a little bit more about that as we get into this. Living cells have a specific number of chromosomes peculiar to their specific kind. All living forms consist of cells, and the cell of each form of life has a fixed number of chromosomes per cell, and that's what it makes, or what makes it, that form of life. Now, human cells have 46 chromosomes each. The chromosomes, of course, have to do with the DNA and other factors that we've been reading about in our textbooks and our newspapers and magazines in recent years. As human cells divide, that's called mitosis, just ordinary cell reduction. Every form of life does this. Its cells gradually divide and make either sustain the life or cause it to grow, or as it ages, it begins to decline as the cell division begins to be reduced. But human cells, as they divide to form new cells, each, every one of them, will have 46 chromosomes. Now, in natural conception, a male contributes one cell, the sperm, and the female one cell, that is the ovum. And if these two cells each contribute 46 chromosomes, the cell resulting from this conception will have 92 chromosomes, a life form that is not human. Now, this is a problem. But as you might expect, the designer had a solution for the problem called meiosis, cell division reduction. When reproductive cells, the sperm and the ovum, form, the chromosomes count is reduced by one half. Thus, in humans, both the male and the female each contribute 23 chromosomes, totaling 46 in the single cell of a new life soul conceived, and that is a human being. And I also say that is not an accident. The very idea that this could have come about by chance, just some sort of cosmic accident producing this, not only in humans, but in every other form of life, is ludicrous. So what we're saying is simply this, that the male has 46 chromosomes per cell, the female 46 chromosomes per cell. If in conceiving a new life, each contributes 46, then the life so conceived has 92 chromosomes. That doesn't work. That's not a human being. That's closer, by the way, to a crawdad than a human being. So that simply doesn't work. No, but in cell division reduction, mitosis, only in the reproductive cells, only the male contributes 23 chromosomes, the female 23 chromosomes, the result is 46 chromosomes in the life thus conceived, and that is not a crawdad. That's a human being. And to that, clearly, yes. As we say, this evidence is design, deliberate, purposing, planning. And design evidences a designer. You point out further that a designer is greater than his design, that is, greater than his work. If, you know, just to put this as simply as I know how, if you were to produce a picture of the old Model T Ford, and here on one side of the picture is the automobile, and on the other side is Henry Ford. Which do you think produced the other? Did the car come from Henry, or did the car produce Henry? It isn't too tough to figure out, is it? That what is design comes from intelligence of a designer. So that when we look at this universe, what then do we see? The designer is greater than the universe he designed. What would you rightly call him? Well, the Bible has no difficulty with this. It calls him God. So from Psalm 19, verse 1, Larry had a depiction up here of a portion of the universe. David said, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Psalm 139, as the psalmist beheld himself, and such simple things that we just take for granted. You ever stop to think about what would happen if, when you are hurt, when you're cut, if the scar tissue did not stop growing when the wound heals? What would happen if, when you get some dust on your eye, your tear ducts don't work? All kinds of just really simple little things. And David's beholding himself, and he said, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and that my soul knows very well. And going to things much more complex, like mitosis. If that did not work, life would be chaotic. Would be just utterly absurd, indefinable. Well, let's take a look at another, again, very simple evidence having to do with the existence of matter. I don't think anybody has any difficulty conceding the fact that matter exists. If you do, then pinch yourself. I think it'll demonstrate the point. There are three possible explanations for the existence of matter. One is that it came into existence from nothing, or that matter is itself eternal, or that it was created. Now, you may have something else in mind other than these three alternatives. Over the years, I've done a little bit of thinking about this subject, and I've never found anything that would not, in one way or another, fit into these three categories. If I'm mistaken about that and you have a different idea, I'd be happy to hear from you. But These are the three that I would come up with. And so we're asking, remember, that it is said that belief in God is unreasonable and lacks harmony with the facts of science. Okay, so we're asking which of these three alternatives is most reasonable and in harmony with the facts of science. Let's talk about this idea that matter, all that is about us, came into existence from nothing. Simply scientifically impossible. It contradicts the first law of thermodynamics, the law of conservation of matter and energy. It is a fact that all matter in our universe and all energy are constant. Now, matter can be changed in form, energy can be utilized and passes into a form that is no longer retrievable and usable, but it is constant. That's what Genesis 2 and verse 1 teaches. And when God brought about this creation, it was finished. Nothing is added to it. Nothing is taken from it. It is finished. And further, mathematically impossible. What school child? Some of us who are older were once school children. As you studied mathematics, arithmetic, very simple arithmetic, what were you taught about zero? Times zero. What does it equal? If you start with nothing, multiply it by nothing, what do you get? Nothing. And don't let this simple thing get away from you, because it's pretty telling. Because what the atheist is trying to convince us of, that everything began with nothing, and that nothing times emptiness equals what? Everything. Zero times zero equals everything? I mean, it's nonsense. Thus, if nothing ever existed, if you could ever conceive of a time when absolutely nothing existed, nothing could and nothing would be now. If you start with nothing, nothing is all you're ever going to have. But matter does exist. Therefore, something has always been. And that which has always been had to be something intelligent enough and powerful enough to create the matter so obviously in existence. The Bible calls him God. Genesis 1, verse 1 and 2. And notice the fact. We made this observation just recently in talking about this in another venue. But the Bible never argues the existence of God. You know, with all of the discussion that goes on about this, you would think that the Bible was just full of arguments trying to prove to people that God exists. It isn't. It simply states the fact. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Why does not the Bible give us so many arguments? Because there is no other viable alternative. There's no need to argue the point. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. Darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved over the face of the waters. Again, Psalm 19 and verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament shows his handiwork. And Paul's statement at Romans 1 verse 20, as he is establishing the existence of God in order to deal with the subject of God's authority and the need for man to respect his God, pointed out the fact that the invisible things of God from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that mankind, in failing to honor his God, is without excuse. Well, how about the idea that matter is itself eternal? That contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. The first and second law of thermodynamics are the most basic fundamental rules of science that are considered, as far as I know. This is the law of entropy, that though the amount of energy in the universe is constant and the expenditure of it reduces the supply of usable energy in direct proportion to the amount expended, and in an irreversible and irrecoverable flow. This demonstrates not eternalness, but temporalness, or that which is temporary. Let's take a couple of examples. I can't think of anything simpler than a cord of firewood. A cord of wood is, 4 feet by 4 feet by 8 feet. But that's 128 cubic feet of firewood. So how in the world does this illustrate the second law of thermodynamics? Well, what do you do with firewood? You burn it. That cord of wood represents a certain amount of thermal energy. That's why you have the stuff, right? Now, as you burn firewood, it now is transformed from this wood that we have been familiar with to what? To ashes. So the form has changed. How about the energy? One somebody said, it's gone. No, it's not. It's still in the universe. It's no longer available to us. We have used this energy and to create or in the form of heat, and a certain amount of it will go up the chimney and some of it will dissipate throughout the house. But it's still in the universe. It's still there. But it's no longer available to us. It has been now used, and the flow of it is in an irreversible direction. We do not get it back, but it is still there. Now let's look at this in a much larger situation. The sun is burning at the rate of 4,600,000 tons per second. Pretty hard to conceive, isn't it? Let me back up a little bit here. Just on that point, eventually what? If the sun burns at this tremendous rate, then eventually what happens? If you were to set a ping pong ball or a baseball, or for that matter, a sculptured piece of wood in a round shape, say the size of a basketball, if you put that thing on fire, if you ignite it, how long will it burn? Well, as long as the combustible material lasts, and then what? It goes out. Reduced ashes, energy is now dissipated into the universe. Eventually, don't panic. This has been going on for a long time, and there's no indication the sun's going to burn out tonight. But eventually, it goes out. What is combustible of the sun will be exhausted. And when it does, our universe does what? Now, people are worried to death about environmentalism, and please don't misunderstand me. I'm not at all in favor of trashing our environment. I believe in taking care of it. I think God intends for us to do that. But people who have the idea that somehow or other, that through our efforts, we are going to preserve this planet forever, are living a dream, a false dream. Because sooner or later, if nothing else happens, the sun burns out and the universe shuts down. That's the second law of thermodynamics. The idea that matter is itself eternal just doesn't work. But God alone is eternal. And that brings us then to the point that creation is the alternative. Let's take a look at Psalms 102. This is an extremely interesting passage in another context. Perhaps you've had some folks that you never met before, but who would like to become very close friends to you. They come from the Watchtower Tract and Bible Society in Brooklyn, New York, and they're trying to convince you that they've got the truth on this matter, and that this earth is going to be renovated, and it will endure forever, and the faithful to God, at least some of them, will live on this earth. Listen to the Psalms. Down here at Psalm 102, we're going to begin reading. I want to start here at verse 24. I said, the psalmist declares, O my God, do not take me away in the midst of my days. Your years are throughout all generations of old. You laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands, they will, what's the word? They will perish. But you, now this is contrasting this universe with the being of God, you will endure. Yes, they will all grow old like a garment, like a cloak. You will change them, and they will be changed in the sense of being renovated and going on. No. You are the same, and your years will have no end. The change that is coming to this universe is its end in contrast to God, who is timeless, who has no end. In Isaiah, the 51st chapter, and at verse 6, Isaiah deals with the same fact, the same concept. What he says here is of interest to us as well. Isaiah 51 and verse 6, lift up your eyes. The prophet is challenging Israel. Lift up your eyes to heavens and look on the earth beneath, for the heavens will vanish away like smoke. The earth will grow old like a garment. What do you do with a garment when it gets old and worn out? I made this point one time preaching in a meeting over in Caldwell, Idaho, and a fellow who just wandered in off the street sitting on the front row up here, and I made this point, what do you do with a garment when it grows old? And he said, I give it to Goodwill. But one way or the other, we pitch the thing. We get rid of it. And so, the psalmist, or the prophet here is making the point that regarding the earth, it will grow old like a garment, and those who dwell in it will die in like manner, but my salvation will be forever. Notice the contrast, that which endures, as compared to that which passes. My salvation will endure forever, and my righteousness will not be abolished. Let's take a look at evidence. Number three, third and last point in this lesson. Again, three possible explanations for the existence of life on earth. One is that it's spontaneously generated from inorganic, that is, inanimate matter. That's called abiogenesis, life originating without life. Or it is itself eternal, or it was created by a living being, life coming from life. That's biogenesis. We're familiar with those terms. We know what bio means, life. We know what genesis means, beginning, as in the first book of the Bible. And so this has to do with life beginning with or from pre-existing life. Now, which of these? We ask the same question. Which of these is reasonable and in harmony with the facts of science? How about the idea that life came into being from inorganic, inanimate matter? Time was when early scientists argued that, thought that, wrote about it. But it's impossible. Life arises only from life. I want to read something to you here. This quotation is very dear to me. And I'll tell you why, briefly. When I was discharged from the military and went back to school, I knew that I would be sitting at the feet of atheistic and evolutionary professors, and frankly, I did not know how to answer their argument. I was raised by parents who were Christians. I was raised to believe in a creator God. That is what I believe, but I had never bothered myself at that point in my life to accrue the proof for that concept, for that conviction. I think I mentioned here a while back that in high school I had a biology teacher who was an evolutionist, not very outspoken about it back in those days, but not secretive either. And I would listen to her make a point once in a while, and as she went on, and I didn't know how to answer her. I didn't believe her, but I did not know how to answer her. Finally, it dawned on me from this quotation just how flimsy the theory of evolution, the general theory of evolution, amoeba to man evolution, how flimsy it is, and how easy it is to refute it. And this is what helped me with this. When I went back to school after my Air Force days, I had to take a class in biology, and this quotation is from the very first reading in the textbook. It says, the evidence of Reddy, this is a reference to a man named Francesca Reddy, who was a 16th century, very early biologist, back when biologists were arguing that life generates spontaneously, silly things that kids sometimes believe, that horse hairs fall into mud puddles and turn into worms. You ever heard that one? You know, just silly stuff. But science back in those days was into that kind of thing. But Francesca Reddy was one who did some experimental work, plus dozens of later scientists who have verified his conclusions, and the one that put the cap on it was Louis Pasteur. For every other part of the world of life point to a continuous line of cells, each organism beginning as a single cell or group of cells arising by an orderly process from pre-existing organisms of the same kind. This is the fundamental doctrine of biogenesis, from bios, life, and genesis, origin, that life begets life, and that life arises in no other way. Spontaneous generation is then called abiogenesis, that is, life arising without life, and is a completely exploded explanation. No life arising from non-living precursors has ever been demonstrated. And I said to myself, I got you. Because the very premise of the general theory of evolution is that somewhere in the primordial sea that this protoplasm, without explaining where that came from, under just the right chemical and external conditions suddenly spontaneously generated life. That's the basis of evolution. When you argue with the evolutionist, he wants to talk about peptides and enzymes and proteins and all of it. When I talked about this with the kids here a while back, you know, with the evening class, I know they all remember, right? I made the point, you know, I don't claim to be the smartest guy in the world, but if somebody asked me to cut down a tree for them, where do you think I start? Am I going to climb up to the top of it, start pulling the leaves off, and then the twigs and the larger branches? What are you going to do with this thing to get it down? You've got to cut it off right at the root. And the root of the theory of evolution is spontaneous generation, for which there is absolutely no scientific evidence. To the contrary, it contradicts the fact of biogenesis. And the theory of evolution cannot get off of the ground without contradicting that which it claims as its fortress, science. And this has never bothered me. From that day in 1954 to this day, and I have never yet discussed this with anybody who had an answer for it. I don't recall exactly. A few years ago, and maybe some of you recall, we had a newspaper article going, and a fellow began to answer. He called himself a humanist preacher, in other words, an advocate for atheism. And he was making fun of us for believing in God and all of this, and I challenged him with this. He did not respond. I challenged him again. How do you explain, I would ask him, the origin of life from non-living matter without contradicting the scientific, biological fact of biogenesis? He's silent as the tomb. And I kept sticking the needle in as often as I could. And finally, one day, he said, And I'm confident he had talked with a lot of people trying to find some help. But he finally said one day, it is true, he said, that there is no proof that life has ever arisen from non-living matter. But, he said, we're working on it. In that same time period, I was back working in my study one day, and knock came on the door, and this fellow wanted to come in and talk to me, and I was happy for the opportunity to do that. He let me know that he was a physicist, a doctor of physics, worked as a professor with the U of O. And he said, I've been reading your stuff, and he said, I get the impression that as you write, that you believe that there is such a thing as absolute truth. Yeah, I do. He said, well, you know, with writings of David Hume and others, we have reasoned our way through this. We understand there's no such thing as absolute truth. Now, this is a physicist making this statement to me, which blew me away to begin with. And I thought about it a little bit, and I finally said to him, you know, if there's no such thing as absolute truth, then your statement to me that there is no such thing as absolute truth cannot be absolutely true, can it? It's not rocket science, is it? It's pretty simple stuff. So this is where I've camped all of these years, never worried about the theory of evolution for a minute since this, and never found anybody who had an explanation that would get him around this point. Thus, since life arises only from life, if there was ever a time when no life existed, life would not and life could not be now. Well, how about the idea that life, earth life, is itself eternal? There's no need to argue this at any length. Again, this contradicts the second law of thermodynamics. All forms of earth life demonstrate origin, birth in mammals. Actually, goes back before that, but we'll confine our discussion to what is observable, and termination, that is death, without exception. Now, for proof, we don't need to argue this point with anybody. We just take him by the hand and we lead him to the hospital, first to the maternity ward, and then to the morgue section. Origin, termination, that's earth life. Well, how about what we have left? Just one alternative, only one, that earth life was created. The only viable explanation. And since life arises only from pre-existing life, there has to be a form of life, eternal in nature, with the intelligence and power to create life. And the Bible calls him God. Let's go to the Genesis record for just a brief look. We're going to wrap this up here very, very shortly. You've been very patient, and I'm grateful to you for that. But in Genesis 1 and verse 11 and 12, in the account of creation, God said, let the earth bring forth grass, the herb that yields seed, and the fruit tree that yields fruit according to what? Its kind, whose seed is in itself on the earth, and it was sown. The earth brought forth grass, the herb that yields seed according to its kind, and the tree that yields fruit, whose seed is in itself according to its kind, and God saw that it was good. Nobody ever planted a kernel of corn and got an apple tree, or a thousand other explanations. Herbal life, vegetation always produces after its kind. Look at verse 20 and 21. God said, let the waters abound with an abundance of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the face of the firmament of the heavens. So God created great sea creatures and every living thing that moves, with which the waters abounded according to their kind. Nobody ever crossed a jackrabbit with a rattlesnake and got a rattle rat. Creatures always reproduce after their kind. That's the way God made them.
And so God blessed them, saying, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth, each after its kind. Well, so also, as we come on down to verse 24, then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth, each according to its kind, and it was so. Then man, verse 26, God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. That's what the Bible teaches, and that is the only viable explanation for the existence of earth on, or life on earth, that can be had. Let's take a look, a very brief look, at just a last little bit here to kind of tie this together. When we look at creation, we're asking which proposition is most reasonable in harmony with the facts of science. We look at creation as compared to macro, that is the general theory of amoeba to man, evolution. It is said of creation by the atheist, that's a special one-time event, and you have to just buy that by faith. Well, no, I don't know anybody that's ever seen God create life. Have you? I wasn't there. I've never seen that. So, yes, I have to hold that by faith. But look at the idea of macroevolution, special one-time event that brought life into existence. G.A. Kirkett, in his book, The Implications of Evolution, you may ask, well, who was Kirkett? Well, he was a biochemist with the University of Southampton in England, wrote a very fine book on evolution, believed it, but pointing out the difficulties with the theory. His tests, the work that he did is in the UofO science library, at least it was a number of years ago, it may still be there. And he pointed out that belief in evolution and life beginning by spontaneous generation is a matter of faith. Nobody has ever seen it, nor is there any evidence for it. But creation, this one-time event, has a special force to bring it about. As we pointed out, it is God. But life by spontaneous generation calls for chance. No special force to cause it, just a cosmic accident. Now, the force that brings about the creation of life on earth is a living God. And that is what life coming from life is, biogenesis. But life from inorganic matter that the evolutionists must argue for is abiogenesis. And as we have pointed out, that is a contradiction of scientific fact. Now, I would just make this one point, and then call this enough for tonight, maybe a little too much, but again, you've been very courteous, and I'm grateful, that the theory of evolution is not based on science. It is based on an effort by so many to avoid acknowledging God and the need of man to be in submission to the will of God, so that what we have in the theory of evolution is a philosophy based on a fairy story. Simple, simple, simple. If this night you are not yet in obedience to the God of your being, and we are going to sing a song of encouragement for you to respond to him by faith in his Son, repentance of sin, confession of your faith, and baptism into Christ for the remission of your sin. We sing the song. For your encouragement, we pray that you'll respond when you do so.